We have with us live in the studios once again, Jav Parrish, co-editor at Eat the Steak. Good morning.
Morning.
No Maria this morning. She is apparently all tuckered out from her vacation.
Oh, poor babe.
Yeah.
Yeah, and that actually puts us and me in particular in kind of an awkward position in terms of the endorsements that we do for the primary election, because we can't really delay them another week. We were going to do them last week, then Maria wasn't here, and we're going to do them this week, and Maria isn't here. And as we've mentioned on the show before, I really shouldn't be commenting on the election because I'm working for a candidate who's in this election, namely Joey Gray, who's one of the candidates for mayor, who jumped in at the last minute. And it behooves me certainly not to comment on the mayor's race, and I really shouldn't be commenting on a whole lot of others either. But it also wouldn't really be very useful to more than a small fraction of our listeners if we waited another week, because that would leave us 3 days before the ballots are due. And of the people in our listening audience who actually lives in Seattle, which is where most of the races on the ballot this time around are centered, we don't have any statewide or federal races this time. And only I believe three different things on the ballot that are even countywide. So I'm going to go ahead and do the endorsements. I did not participate in the Eat the State endorsements this time around for the same reason, because of the conflict of interest. So I can certainly talk about those. Because I didn't participate, I actually don't agree with a couple of the endorsements that Jeff Stevens, who coordinated the process, did. So for the things that aren't the mayor or the city council, which are the positions that work the most closely with the mayor, here's the compromise. I'm not going to say anything that I haven't said publicly before, for the mayor and city council, or that isn't on the, part of the Eat the State endorsements. For the others, I'll go ahead and do them. I talked with Joey last night about this, and she's sort of reluctantly okay with it. So hopefully it won't create a problem. I do need to emphasize that in all of these, I'm speaking for myself. I'm not speaking for the campaign. If you got a problem with anything I have to say, don't take it out on the campaign or don't attribute it to the campaign, because I'm not speaking in that capacity, period, end of story. And then there are the usual caveats that come with our endorsements as well, which is, as people who've listened to this show over the years know, that we always encourage people to do their own research. Don't take our word as gospel, because it is as fallible as any other set of opinions. That's what it is, an opinion. Mm-hmm. And we really encourage people to do their own research and to make up their own minds and not take anyone's word on
faith. Do your own
faith.
Thinking.
And then also, voting is an important part of the democratic process, particularly since it is the one time in our political system when a reasonably large number of people are actually trying to pay attention to what's going on. But it is not the sole thing that's necessary to affect change in our society. It is at best the end product after a lot of organizing has been done and you have candidates that actually can reflect the public will and will do the public will once in office. And we are nowhere near that in most elected offices right now. So if you really want to see change, sure, vote if you want to. Don't vote if you want to. But by all means, get out there and participate and organize. Because that's where the change will come from in the long run.
Democracy is heck of a lot more than just voting.
Yes.
So with that.
With all that out of the way, let's go ahead and start. And I'm going to save the mayor and city council until last.
Okay.
So let's look at some of the other things on the ballot. It's a relatively short ballot this time, which is why we're doing it all in one day. And we would do it all in one day even if Maria were here to do a lot of the talking. King County Executive, let's start with the King County things first, since, as I said, there's nothing statewide or federal this year. The King County Executive incumbent Dow Constantine is facing several opponents in the primary. None of them are particularly well suited to replace him. And Constantine, I think anyway, has done a pretty good job. So I would heartily agree with Jeff's endorsement of Constantine for re-election here. There are a couple of council seats in particular that are of interest. The North Seattle seat that has been abandoned by Bob Ferguson because he was elected to statewide office as the Attorney General. Rod Dombrowski was appointed to replace him and is up for filling out the rest of Ferguson's term this year. And he is a pretty good – he's a Democrat. He's done a – although it's a nonpartisan office, he's done a pretty good job, and I think he's actually done a very good job, I think, as a progressive replacing Ferguson, who in many ways also was fairly progressive. We're urging re-election for him as well. The other interesting one on the ballot is not in Seattle per se. It's on the east side, which is King County's council seat number 5, Regan Dunn's seat. Dunn was Ferguson's opponent for the attorney general race, was supposed to be a really strong Republican candidate, what with being the son of a Republican icon and so forth, and the fact that he's a smarmy Tea Party trust fund baby really didn't, he's not a very appealing character, and he's way more conservative than even rural King County should be comfortable with. And he is for the first time, but he's running for re-election on county council anyway, since of course he kept his council seat when he lost the statewide race. And for the first time, he is facing a really challenged, credible challenger in Democrat Sherry Song, who's a Korean American immigrant and small business owner, very savvy, running a very good campaign. And for folks who live out in that part of King County, we're strongly encouraging support for her, and hopefully we can get Regan Dunn off of county council and if we're really lucky, out of politics entirely after two losses in a row. And then King County also has the only ballot measure of the primary election, which is Proposition Number 1, the Parks Levy. And once again, of course, as many local governments have taken to doing, especially the city and the county, they're pulling this trick of putting a pretty essential service that everybody loves on the ballot for a levy, whereas they take things like, say, to pick a random example, the Sonics, where not a lot of people are necessarily supportive of it, and they don't put those in front of the voters. They put them in the general budget that people don't have any impact over. But that being said, the parks levy is necessary in order to fund the parks, and so we are urging a yes vote on it, but doing so with the awareness that we're being manipulated, because the stuff that we really ought to be voting on or consulted as voters and taxpayers as to whether it's a good idea or not, they don't ask us about those things. So,
all right. So, schools and port?
Yeah. School board, there's a couple of primaries where there are multiple candidates. Position number 4 is a really clear-cut choice. The establishment candidate in this race is a education reformer named Suzanne Dale Esty. She is, when you see reformer in this context, it usually means somebody who has ties to the charter school and for-profit education movement. And, Suzanne Dale Esty has that, up the wazoo. She has, all the wrong allies in this case. Whereas somebody who, full disclosure, is a personal friend and former Seattle Weekly colleague of mine, Sue Peters, she, as her day job, was a culture critic for the Weekly for several years while I was there. Wonderful person, always been very supportive of Eat the State and of this program. And she's also been for many years an education activist, worked with PTSA groups, pushing the school board very hard to listen to parents and to engage in some meaningful reform. She was a leading voice against the school closures a few years ago when that was happening, has continued to be very active. She is running for this seat also, and she's run a very good campaign, and so a very enthusiastic endorsement for Sue Peters in school board school board position number 4. Something common to almost every thing on the ballot this time is either it's a really clear choice or it is a really, really muddled choice. There's nothing that's, well, this candidate is somewhat better than that candidate, so we'll go with this one over that one. It's all either really open and shut or it's really messy. And school board position number 8 is one of the messy ones. This is one of the ones where my opinion diverges from Jeff Stevens, who wrote the state endorsement. He endorsed Stephen Blanford for this position, and Blanford clearly does have more qualifications than the other people running, because the other people running, frankly, aren't really up to speed on school board issues. That said, Blanford also has a lot of the same ties that Suzanne Del Este does to the charter school and for-profit education movement. It looks like he would very much be yet another person on the school board who would be part of the problem rather than part of the solution, in terms of being part of the sort of, you know, insiders club that has really been a barrier to public accountability for the school district for most of the last two decades. We had one brief exception where we had a majority of reformers on the board about a decade ago. But by and large, this has been a problem for a long time, and Blanford, I think, would be more of the problem. The problem is that the two challengers in the race aren't very good either. The best of them is probably Olu Thomas. My preference would be to skip this position entirely, because I really, in good conscience, don't want to see any of the candidates on the school board. But if you have to pick one of them, I would pick Thomas over Blanford. Then we go to Port Commissioner, which is another very similar situation where I wouldn't really want to vote for any of these folks. Jeff Stevens went for Stephanie Bowman, who was appointed to fill a vacant position earlier this year. She's a former person working with the Port of Tacoma. Again, reasonably well qualified, up to speed on the issues, but has all of the wrong alliances in terms of any hope for any kind of accountability or in for corruption at the port. And, it's been true for a very long time. The school district and the port are the two agencies in our local area that by far have the most contempt for the public. And the port in particular, I think, is also the most corrupt public agency that really we have going in this region. I think Bowman be more of a part of the problem. And again, she's running against people who aren't particularly desirable or qualified. Andrew Pallode is probably the best of the challengers, I think. But my tendency in this one would be to skip it entirely. And that brings us to the city elected officials. We have two council races on the ballot for the primary. For the other two, there's only one challenger running against the incumbent, so those go directly to the November ballot. That's also true in the county council races that are not on the ballot this time. Council position number two, I kind of have to be careful of what I say here because of my day job. But I will say that the strangers' actions this electoral season have been pretty consistently highly problematic, with one significant exception, which is that they nailed Richard Conlon in their endorsement issue, and it was a thing of beauty. I won't go and re-quote it, but their phrase of Conlon, greenwashing liberal fraud, as listeners of the show know for a while, pretty much accurately sums up what Marie and I have been saying about Conlon for a very long time. He has steadily moved from being sort of the great hope of a great hope of progressives when he was first elected 16 years ago to being the biggest problem on city council in 2013 in terms of being in the pocket of wealthy developers, having a socially regressive agenda, and so forth. And there are a couple of challengers for him. One, Brian Carver, we talked about a couple weeks ago around the revelations that his campaign was largely financed by a Indian religious group called the Art of Living. He has not run a particularly effective or compelling campaign. The third candidate in the race has run a great campaign, and she is a wonderful candidate, Shama Sawant. She ran against Frank Chop last year as an open socialist and still got nearly 30% of the vote. And she's run a very strong race this year also, and appears to be ahead of the Carver in the polls as someone who can go on and challenge Conlon and give him a fairly strong challenge in the general election. I don't think it's any particular secret. I think she's great. She is heads and shoulders above any socialist affiliate candidate who has run for local office in their area in a long, long time. And so an enthusiastic endorsement there. Mayor, Jeff did a dual endorsement of Peter Steinbrook and Joey Gray, Joey being the candidate that I'm working with. He has been a longtime backer of Peter Steinbrook. which I certainly understand. And I think started out this election season planning to push really strongly for Peter's sole endorsement. And the fact that even though I didn't participate in the process at all, that Jeff came to the conclusion that Joey was really a dual endorsement says a lot about how good a progressive she is as well. I'm not going to say anything more about that. I will say that of the four leading candidates, McGinn and Murray and Steinbrück and Harrell, I started this election process thinking that each of them had some very worthy things that they've done in their careers and some flaws. I've said on the air before, and so I don't think it's any revelation to say it again, that I think McGinn's behavior around SPD should all by itself disqualify him from ever holding elected office again, let alone being reelected mayor. I think it is a fair statement, and I'm going to stop here. I wish I could explain further, and maybe in a couple weeks, once the election is over, I will. But with the exception, I would say, of Kate Martin and, of course, of Joey, I don't think there is anybody in this race of whom, having seen it really up close and been to a number of the public events and talked personally with pretty much all of the other candidates at one point or another, I don't think there is anybody else in the race other than Joey and Kate Martin who I am not less enthusiastic about as a potential mayor now than I was months ago. They have all been problematic in some way or another, and I'm just going to stop there because I don't want to get myself in trouble with my day job.
All right.
But that's the dual endorsement that that Ethan State came up with was Peter and Joey, and maybe Maria will have more to say next week. We'll find out.
What about Mike O'Brien's position? Is that
Oh, I'm sorry, I skipped that one. Yeah, that's City Council position number 8, and O'Brien and his main challenger is a guy named Albert Shen, who came out as a candidate from the Asian American community, really without a whole lot of politics, but discovered very quickly that a whole lot of really powerful people would like to see Mike O'Brien out. O'Brien has really, I think, and this again is something that I've said publicly before, so I don't think I'm getting myself into trouble by saying this. He's really come into his own in the last year or two. He came on the council seen largely as an ally of Mike McGinn. They both had strong Sierra Club roots. They both were elected with the same sort of core environmental constituency. And O'Brien has really developed, I think, especially even in the last 6 months to a year, as a strong second progressive on the council along with Nick Licata, which was something that was really needed. And because of that, he's made all the right enemies, and they are now backing Albert Chen's campaign. So, for the two council races, very, very strong endorsements in both cases, one for Mike O'Brien, the other for Sean Maswan.
All right.
And by the way, I should mention also that Shama is having a fundraising party tonight, so anybody can go to her Facebook page and check that out, too.
All right. Moving on, we got about 10 minutes left to cover the rest of the news, starting with a memo that came out this week about the tunnel.
Yeah, this a report in Publicola that Seattle Public Utilities sent out an email detailing all of the problems that they had run into with construction of the Deep Port Tunnel downtown. In mid-July, the Washington State Department of Transportation had issued a temporary stop work order on the Seattle Tunnel Project, which is the consortium of contractors that's working on the tunnel, after workers had slammed into a Seattle City Light electrical vault and a public utility sewer line late last month. And it turns out those are simply the latest in a long line of construction problems, which the public utilities email spelled out, sent to the mayor's staff. The email, and you can Google it, is titled A Brief History of Board Tunnel Construction Impacts to SPU Facilities. Going from last year through spring of this year, it's caused, among other things, excessive settlements from dewatering, a red alert level, water main leaking, failure to notify SPU of legal discharge into Elliott Bay, unusual readings in overflow monitoring systems resulting in a third discharge violation, and knocking the top off a combined sewer maintenance hole and failure to notify Seattle Public Utilities, causing a dry weather overflow. The email also documents the tunnel project's petulant, and this is a direct quote, petulant and delinquent responses to warnings. It just goes on. We don't have a lot of time here, but the final item in Seattle Public Utilities email documents the collision with the sewer line in June. With a very sarcastic "see a pattern here" and adding a lot of details about near misses with electrical conductors, sewer backups, and reporting that workers were exposed to sewage and required medical treatment. These kinds of problems, a lot of critics of the tunnel were saying there were going to be a lot of construction problems in opposing the tunnel in the first place, because the tunnel is so technically challenging. They're trying to do something in terms not only of the length of the tunnel, but the fact that it's happening, you know, so close to a body of salt water that has never been done before. And, you know, in terms of cost overruns, in terms of time overruns, complexity of the work, mishaps like this, it's just problems begging to happen. And those predictions now appear to be coming true.
All right. Vote this week at SeaTac?
Yeah, the city of SeaTac, we talked about this last week, that the city council there was scheduled Tuesday night, to vote on whether to put a livable wage initiative on their fall ballot. They did vote to support that, and they did so despite the Alaska Airlines and Washington Restaurant Association lawsuit seeking an injunction to prevent them to do that. That lawsuit was not successful in getting an injunction, as I discussed last week. It was legally pretty dubious and not likely to succeed in the court. The real point was to put pressure on the city council. So now it does move to the fall ballot, and there's going to be an enormous amount of money from corporate interests pouring into the small city of SeaTac, population 25,000, to try and shoot this down on the ballot. And I hear rumors and whisperings also that there are people in Seattle looking at putting a similar initiative with a $15 an hour minimum wage and various other pro-worker conditions onto the Seattle ballot next year. So let's see what comes of that.
All right. Vote this week coming up at the Seattle City Council?
Yeah, Seattle City Council, meanwhile, has a key vote coming up on Monday around homeless encampments. This is in the wake of the measure about a month ago to shut down Nicholsville on September 1st. And subsequently, the city has given $500,000 to Union Gospel Mission to help the homeless move out of Nicholsville, which in itself problematic because, and is one of the other things I do in my day life, is I'm president of the board of a local shelter in the U District Roots. And among the homeless, Union Gospel Mission actually has a very poor reputation because of their requirement that people go to chapel and you know, get essentially lectured to about religious matters in order to receive any help, which a lot of people resent, not surprisingly. The council, however, will be voting Monday on a measure that's been sponsored by Nicola Codd and Mike O'Brien to expand where encampments can be allowed. Right now, they're only allowed on church property or city property, which is why there's been these repeated issues with Nicholsville over being on public property and why city council has had such direct oversight over where Nicholsville can stay and for how long. It would expand the legislation to allow some homeless encampments on private non-residential land. That vote Monday afternoon. So if you want to have input on that, by all means, go and make yourself heard.
All right. On to National and Halliburton.
Yeah, Halliburton pleading guilty to destroying evidence in the Gulf oil spill from a couple of years ago. It does make you wonder what BP, which quite probably stands for blatant perjury, and all the various subcontractors like Halliburton were hiding when you literally had international waters where these rigs were located and where the spill was spreading into being declared off limits, not just to media and reporters, but also to government officials while in the critical first couple of weeks of that spill, while they were trying to contain it and while they were trying to, apparently we learn now, hide some of the evidence of what actually happened on those rigs. So we may be finding out more. By the way, even though they pleaded guilty and that made headlines, the maximum fine that Halliburton can get by pleading guilty to that is $300,000, which given that Halliburton is a multi-billion-dollar corporation, it's roughly the annual cost of what they spend to polish the gold plating on the executive washrooms. So I don't think Halliburton will be losing any sleep over that one.
All right. Report out this week about coal-fired power plants?
Yeah, a report by Waterkeeper Alliance, Environmental Integrity Project, the Clean Water Action, Earth Justice, Beyond Coal, and the Sierra Club, which is pretty much a who's who of groups working on coal fire plants in the U.S., shows government complicity in dirty coal, specifically a review of 386 coal fire plants. That's all of the coal fire plants across the country. It shows that the Clean Water Act has been almost universally ignored by both power companies and permitting agencies at the federal and state level. And I just want to go through and read some of these to give you an idea of how bad it is. Of the 108 permits examined for coal plants in 13 southern states, which is all of the southern states, the report found that only 40 of those 108 set any limits at all on pollutants. Of the 20 permits for coal plants in Kentucky, for example, none set limits. There were none for the 8 in Georgia, the 7 in Virginia, 4 in Arkansas, 3 in Mississippi. Nationally, nearly half of the coal plants, 187 out of the 380, are operating with expired Clean Water Act permits. That's a federal issue that goes directly on the Obama administration. But wait, it's not entirely on the Obama administration, because 53 of those 187 are operating with permits that expired at least 5 years ago. And by the way, this report came out before sequester, so there's even less money available for enforcement and oversight now than there was, say, 6 months ago. Of the 274 plants that are discharging, 102 have no requirements at all to monitor or report discharge of toxic pollutants to government agencies or to the public, and 71 of the coal plants discharge toxic pollutants into rivers, lakes, streams, and bays that have already been designated as impaired due to poor water quality. 3 out of 4 of those plants have no permits limiting the amount of toxic metals they can dump into those bodies of water. So the next time you hear somebody talk about clean coal, just remember that.
All right. Decision out this week by Holder, Eric Holder?
Yeah, Department of Justice and Attorney General Eric Holder moving this week to try and restore the impact of the Voting Rights Act that was gutted by the Supreme Court in its decision last month. They had only invalidated in their ruling one section of the act, the Section 4 that covers where it can be enforced. Section 5, which requires permission from federal authorities before covered jurisdictions can make voting procedures, is still in place. So in order to trigger that, Holder is trying to do something else using a provision from Section 3 that gets largely to the same place called bail-in. If the department can show that given directions have committed constitutional violations, federal courts can then impose federal oversight on those places in a piecemeal fashion. And this is likely also to be challenged in court, but it is good to see that the Obama administration is at least trying to fight back when a conservative court disenfranchises millions of Americans.
All right. And finally, Antarctica.
Yeah, a new study out that ground ice and permafrost in the Antarctic is now melting as rapidly in the Arctic. This is different. Temperatures rises have for a number of years been higher in the Arctic regions than in the Antarctic. We've had some ice melts in the Antarctic, notably that huge sheet on the Ross Ice Shelf. But unlike the Arctic, ground ice in Antarctica has generally been considered pretty stable. But it's now melting as rapidly as it is in the Arctic, not because temperatures are rising as rapidly, but due to increased solar radiation thawing the ground ice faster. That disrupts normal seasonal ice patterns, and the cause of the increased solar radiation is for now uncertain, although it is, of course, related to changes in weather patterns. So once again, a study on climate change, and as just about always, I can't remember an exception, it finds that things are worse than we thought.
Events.
Tuesday at 4:30 on July 30th, Youth in Danger. There'll be a Police Brutality and the School of Prison Pipeline march and rally that'll go from Garfield High School to King County Detention Center. The rally's march starts at Garfield at High School at 23rd and Jefferson at 4 o'clock. And then on Wednesday evening, there will be a weigh-in on Hanford cleanup, a public hearing at 5:30 p.m. on Wednesday the 31st at University Heights Center. That's at 50th and the Ave, between the Ave and Brooklyn on the north side of the University District.
Talking as we do every week with Jav Parrish, co-editor at Eat the State. Where do people find Eat the State?
Eat the State is at www.eatthestate.org. Once again, there are the endorsement article is front and center there, and there are several comments on there that take issue with the same endorsements that I had a problem with. So you can also see what some of those concerns are as well. So it's www.eatthestate.org.